I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Barbara L. Bear is, simply put, one of the most interesting people I have ever met, and she joins us today with her latest novel set in the south of India, The Last Devadasi, where passionate and forbidden love clashes with tradition and caste. Later in the show, we'll visit with Hilary Moore and members of the Off the Page Readers Theater, who will preview some of their literary theater in advance of their upcoming performances later in the month. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Barbara L. Bear has lived all over the world, South India, Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Russia. She founded Floriant Press, whose notable publications are the women's anthology, Cartwheels on the Fault Line, Pomegranate Roads, and her own Grisha the Scrivener. We last visited with Barbara with her novel, The Ballet Lover. Barbara has long been interested in dance and has studied it and written about it, and now pulls us into the world of Indian dance with The Last Devadasi. Barbara herself studied this ritual form of Indian dance while living in southern India. Let's listen to our conversation. Barbara Bear, The Last Devadasi is your latest book, and I have to say that each book you write seems so different from the last one. The Last Devadasi is set in southern India and, like your last book, has something to do with dancing and dancers, but of course the plot is more involved than that. So tell us first, what is The Last Devadasi, or a Devadasi, and what brought you into the land of southern India?
Thank you for having me to speak about this. I'm very happy to. I lived in what was then Madras, now called Chennai, Madras State in southern India, in the 1960s, and I set the novel a bit more ahead in the 1970s. And when I went to India, I got out of grad school, I had a teaching job at a woman's college, part of a system that's like the British system, where there are colleges connected to all part of university. So I was teaching young girls who were just a little bit younger than I was. It was very hot. I got very sick right away, but the whole experience was marvelous teaching. They were so young and eager. I met a man who was a vocal singer in the Carnatic tradition and an American, and he introduced me to a dancer named Balasaraswati, who was the most famous and renowned dancer of this most classical South Indian form called Bharatanatyam. Many other forms of dance in what's called Karnataka, the South Indian area, before it was divided up into these rather arbitrary states. Each area had a unique dance form that developed, but the basic form came from Bharatanatyam. For example, in the neighboring western state of Kerala, the form is called Kathakali, and in the state north of Madras state, it's in Odisha state, it's called Odissi, and so on. And it's different from North Indian dance, which we know probably a bit more Kathak, but they're very similar roots. They combine pure dance, lots of rapid gestures, with what's called Abhinaya, expressive dance, or the language of gestures, so that there's a language with the hands, the eyes. It's very much almost like characters in Chinese or Japanese. They all mean something. There are many variations. So Balasaraswati, who by that time was past her prime as a performer, but she was much renowned. And what was also became fascinating to me was not only how I adored her personally and her incredibly expressive dance. From the first moment I saw her at a performance at the Music Academy in Madras, I fell in love with this expressive dance. I didn't understand it, but something absolutely reached me, which has been my experience with dance throughout my life. I'm not a dancer, though I've studied dance, but I'm drawn to something that seems to be speaking a language that people who love music hear in their music and people who love art see in their art, which is you feel as though you understand something beyond what's in the score or on the canvas or on the stage. So Balasaraswati came from hereditary matriarchal line called Devadasis. No one knows their real true origins. So in the novel, I have a character who's trying to find out the origins of the Devadasis. All that's really known for sure is that women dedicated themselves or were dedicated at a young age to belong to a temple and to commit themselves for their lives to serving the deities of the temple. And in that regard, they'd been married symbolically to an image or statue of the deity. So if it were in a temple where Krishna was the deity, they'd be married to Krishna. Or where Shiva was the deity, they'd be married to Shiva. Or to many other, you know, stand-ins for the gods. They were revered, these women, because they were the most literate. They were the repositories of this dance form that was supposedly come from the ancient scriptures. But at the same time, because they were married symbolically to gods, they could not be married to human husbands. And so they belonged to the temple, but they were also could be used by men in the temple, priests and upper caste men who would become their common law husbands. This put them in a very tenuous position. It also, and this is unknown, how the caste became untouchable. So the Devadasis, who were, it literally means servant of the god, Devadasis, they were most critical in the temple rituals and worship. They danced, they served the deities, they provided the food symbolically for the deities in the shrines. At the same time, they were used sexually by men, and because it was the lower parts of the body or the unclean parts of the body, they became an untouchable caste, an unclean caste. Now they call, there's another name, they don't use untouchable, Dalit, they call it. All of it means, though, that in the very rigid caste society of South India, they occupied simultaneously the very lowest rung and, in a sense, the highest rung, that they were part of this, the Brahmins, priests' worship. So this Balasaraswati, my dance teacher, had been born into this caste. It had been outlawed. Dedicating girls had been outlawed on the insistence of Gandhi after India gained independence because it was so unfair to women. And as temples lost their prominence, making a living as a dancer became less and less possible. So many were forced into various things, prostitution in some way or another. So this fascinated me, this sacred and profane. And I also knew that the kind of dance that came from it. It had many meanings. It was very sensual and physical, sexual. At the same time, it was truly reaching for the divine, a union with the divine, as Hinduism is. So although I was just a complete novice and really naive, I just took to it. And I became a student of Balasaraswati's. I became a kind of adopted member of their family. And I did that for 3 years as I lived in South India while I taught Shakespeare and Dickens and Jane Austen and so on to these very darling young women who I taught.
So this has obviously been with you for a very long time.
A really long time.
And brewing, maybe, of how to tell a story that involved this culture that fascinated you so much. And in the book, The Last Devadasi, is Kamala, who is an actress. And she's kind of the focal point of a lot of the activity, and the man who loves her and is also fascinated with the whole nature of the Devadasi. And the story itself seems to have a real multicultural element, as the one of the other young characters, Celeste, is... The book starts out with her being deposited at a convent in a basket as an orphan, and the story's somewhat told through her lens. But how did you get this blending of characters that all seem to have their tangent coming in, and but their own story and their own backstory? And Jules, the man who is in love with Kamala, is himself kind of an interesting person with an interesting background.
Somehow, I seem to be able to write about women who, if not easier to explain, easier for me to understand. The men that I've written about all have some real oddities. They're all sort of obsessives or have a lot of hiddenness in their lives, as does Jules. The character of Celeste, Marie Celestine, and then she simplifies her name to Celeste when she comes to Madras, because where she was deposited as a newborn is French-speaking, a little enclave of France in southern India called Pondicherry. And when she comes to Madras, Chennai, I'm going to call it Madras because that's what I knew, although now it is Chennai. It's English-speaking. So she adapts when she's a very adaptable girl. I really don't know where she came from, except that one of the young women who helped Balasaraswati teach Bharatanatyam was such a young, innocent girl who nevertheless knew how to navigate her way in this rather complex world of Balasaraswati had internationally famous people coming to her, friends and admirers. And this young woman somehow seemed able to keep her cool and her integrity while really not being knowledgeable about what was going on. And somehow I just found that this person might interpret the rather out-of-control behavior of some of the other characters as a sort of calm center to it. But she's really, made up. But I think that the source of it is this young woman who was Balasaraswati's assistant named Shamala, who I liked so much and who... It was really fun because she was having a flirtation with another dance master, but they never could have been permitted because they were very different castes. So they could have this flirtation while seeming to teach me dance. I don't know. It was a lot of fun for me, and I think for them, and that was part of it. And the Jules character... An obsessive, somehow men who at least interest me to write about have some sort of obsession that they can't really understand or get to the bottom of, which I think is often true with people. They substitute, in a way, something for something else that's deeper inside. And if it's creative, if it's positive, that's good. If it's not, it could be destructive.
For him, it was a little bit of both.
A little of both. Yes. Yes. I tried. I thought I would write about the Devadasis because it was so fascinating, but I really was not able to. I couldn't read original sources in Tamil or Sanskrit, and so I turned to fiction, where you can do whatever you want, and it's fiction, and a character may be on the right or wrong path. That's just the way it is. And today, there is still, despite the law passed, I think, in the 1940s, at Gandhi's insistence, there are still dedication of girls, and they still call them Devadasis. They do not dance or sing. They're generally poor families, do not know how they can bring up girls, and they dedicate them as young as 7 or 8 to a goddess called Yelama, a fertility goddess. And there's a fair every year of dedicating these young girls who are then really bought by men. Either, you know, kind of like a promise, well, she's only 7 now. When she's 12, I've already paid for her. And they have a very bad fate, particularly with social, you know, with AIDS and so on. And there are groups that are rescuing them. It has made the practice, the former practice of the Devadasi caste, it's tarnished it greatly. And I want to say that a young woman who came to give a little bit of a demonstration when I gave a reading, she said, and it's true, it's upper caste girls who are now learning Bharatanatyam. It's a part of a social prestige. And they also may be, you know, very talented. And once you begin to learn anything, you want to learn more. You want to be better. And this is true particularly, there's many, you know, big Indian community in California. When you look online, you'll see all these schools of Bharatanatyam and Bollywood and Odissi and Kuchipudi, these other forms. In the South Bay, dozens of teachers. In the East Bay, dozens of schools. So it's there, and probably most of these girls are from upper caste families learning art.
That's the irony of that kind of transformation, that now a Devadasi is sold into sexual slavery.
Yeah.
And it is the upper caste who are learning this.
A form that was, yeah. It comes from the Devadasis. I suppose, you know, mostly they will dissociate themselves, the young women today, from that. The most famous South Indian singer named Subbalakshmi, if anybody likes Carnatic music, she was from the Devadasi caste, as was Balasaraswati. But with them, they weren't the very last, but really the last of those who were honored almost a bit later for being the great artists and for also carrying on this tradition. It then segued somewhat into a, I really think, a more sanitized form of it, where it's almost completely the songs, which are then illustrated, danced with language of gestures, they became almost completely devotionally meant, much less the sexual. And I could imagine that in the past, when the dancers, Devadasis danced before, would be an audience of men, no women, there would have been innuendos that were part of the dance and made it, somehow gave it what the, both the sensual and the spiritual. Now it tends to be more, I think, on the spiritual side. Proper for proper young ladies.
In your book, though, it is on the sensual side, and that kind of pulsates through the book as well. One of your characters, I think Kamala says, there is no beginning nor end to our stories. And That's kind of how I saw this story of the last Devadasi, this kind of weaving of threads into these avenues of characters coming together or missing each other at times. But Kamala is an actress, a rising starlet, but in some ways, I thought she did incarnate that Devadasi spirit about her. And little Celeste was the innocent in it all, judged nothing and was wide-eyed through the whole thing. And by the end of the story, it seems like many of the characters find some sort of contentment through their journey. And I think about another character in the book who is also a dancer, and her name is Angela, and she is a ballerina. And in your last book, you focused on the world of ballet. But I thought that that was an interesting kind of juxtaposition with Angela talking about being a ballerina and the pain involved in dance. Yet she then comes to learn this dance form and excel at it and embrace it as a freedom for herself almost. So
it's easier on her feet because the ballerina has tormented feet because of wearing the toe shoes with the blocks and dancing on point with all the blisters and bunions and calluses and deformations. And the Indian dancer dances flat-footed, barefoot on the ground. And I always loved that about Indian dance, that tangibleness with the earth. There's also a lot of reaching and lightness to it, but they're always grounded in the earth. And so in some way, Angela finds a release in learning this dance, and she finds a meaning. She didn't have any meaning. She was quite a lost girl, and finds that she then can pursue something, because if there's anything true of dancers and so many people, if one can't throw oneself into a passion and set, you know, kind of an agenda for the next period in your life learning, you're kind of lost.
Well, she didn't play a huge part in the book, but she went through a real marked transformation in the book, I thought. And it was all about dance.
It was about dance. It certainly wasn't about love, which she wasn't going to get from her husband, who was remained in love with Kamala.
Well, in the book, and I'm talking with Barbara Bear about her novel, The Last Devadasi, storytelling is within it as well, that Kamala, who is an actress and is a dancer, and then she has visions of stories that she has Celeste write down. And so in the structure of the book, there's then a new story that we can follow a bit. And tell us a little bit about your writing and structuring of the book.
How I came, I think I imagined Kamala in some way displacing her failed relationship with Jules into a story where he would be somewhat of a fictional character in her story. It also was she wanted to show that she was learned in some way. So I think she wants to prove that she also can tell Jules in the world that she's has a brain and can tell a story. So she tells the story of, again, telling the story of a Devadasi, because within it is a young girl of that cast who isn't a dancer because she only has one eye and is too much, wouldn't be seen as beautiful. So she has to just be, to to eat and have shelter has to be the mistress or concubine of a few men. And so Kamala wants to tell this her own story in an oblique way. And that was why that story's within a story. And in a sense, there's another story within a story, which is a man that Jules meets during the monsoon when he's stranded in a train station in Madurai. And he meets a man providentially who seems like this is what a novelist gets to do, put people in providentially, a man who's going to help Jules with his research on the origin of the Devadasis. Well, the man is a kind and generous man, but also with his own difficulties, his problems, he's sexually repressed. And once he begins to study these voluptuous Devadasis of old, he becomes kind of taken over by them. Because there's a lot in Hinduism, there's a lot about, for the upper castes, particularly Brahmins, resisting sexual temptation, as there is in Christianity, whatever. We know all of this. Resist the flesh. And so, in fact, an upper caste male, a Brahmin or even a third caste, the warrior caste, could go with a Devadasi to someplace, have sexual intercourse, but as long as they did not drink water or anything, did anything connected with the mouth, if they limited this sexual congress to the lower parts of the body and then purified themselves afterward, they would not have been made impure. So it all had to do, I think, at the source of so much of this is the division between the pure and the impure. And, you know, we had it too, the Madonna and the whore. It's and the separation of the somehow spiritual and the earthly or whatever.
So you bring a lot of this color into the telling of your story. And Barbara, I'm wondering if you might read something from The Last Devadasi for us.
I can, and I will. This is from the fourth chapter. And the novel is an ensemble novel in a way that there are four characters whose stories and lives interweave, connect, collide, resolve. I tend to like a better ending rather than not. This is from the fourth chapter. In the shade of Ahmed Jamal's awning, Jules unrolled new lengths of printed handloom fabrics, stroking one deep gray cotton with its unusual water design and weave. He smoothed his hand over another burnt orange raw silk that made color rise to his cheeks with memories it brought. The other men raised their eyes from the bolt of orange silk to watch a row of five coolie women drive their bony cattle ahead of them, barely breaking the rhythm of their stride to pick up the wet cow droppings, slap them into pancakes, and press them to dry on the crumbling sidewalks. Jules admired the upright posture of the women, who hadn't an ounce of fat on their bodies, and the confident way they tied their faded red saris up high between their legs to be able to stride as freely as men while swinging their hips with distinctive womanly motions. Small Mohammedan boys wearing white skullcaps dashed out to tempt the earliest shoppers toward their stalls. "Ma, ma, wedding saris from Varanasi, nice infant underclothing." Jules and Ahmed knew it was too early for matrons to buy. Before she made a purchase, a bride's mother would unfurl dozens of saris when the heat in the stalls was so intense that the primary colors of silk from Kanchi and Bengali weavers glimmered before her eyes, crimsons and gold shimmering in the sun, as bright as marriage jewelry itself. Ahmed offered Jules a green mango speckled with red pepper powder. The men ate the dense, smooth, mouth-puckering flesh cupped in their hands, leaning out over the street. That's the marketplace where Jules has a business. He has an export of cloth business in Madras.
I was struck by, throughout the book, your mentioning of food.
Always.
Just made me want to go eat.
Yeah. Well, South Indian food, which you can find much more, I'm sure, in the South Bay here. There'll be lots of South Indian restaurants. And East Bay, I don't think there's any South Indian restaurant here. They're usually North Indian or Nepali or something. It's wonderful. It's very different, much lighter, spicy, but lighter than North Indian food, usually vegetarian.
Yes, I think sometimes we have a rather one-dimensional view of Indian food.
I think because we just don't know it. And it's different in every state. I mean, in Kerala, although even Brahmins eat fish, which they call the vegetables of the sea, and the same in Bengal, they eat fish, but they don't eat any other creature with eyes. But theirs is a wonderful, much milder cuisine. Lots of coconut milk and vegetables and leaves and so on. And others are different and wonderful.
And are you going to read another passage there from the movie studio?
I'll read from the movie studio. Yeah. Kamala Kumari is a starlet. She comes from this Devadasi caste. She'd been trained in classical dance, and she always knows it. She has this, but the way to live in the modern times is to be in the movies. And so she's in the movie, and she's very beautiful. Kamala Kumari took quick little steps along a parapet that wobbled above a blue tarp printed with white wavelets. Bright camera lights outlined her aquiline nose, full pensive lips, swooping dark brows. A rhinestone-studded blue chiffon scarf loosely covered her hair. The close-up centered on her powdered cleavage, modest enough for the censors, provocative enough to make men in the balcony seats lean forward. The overhead mics picked up loud clanking in the background, distracting noises, traffic and horns from Gemini's studio gate increased the din. Kamala turned for a full-face close-up, only to break out laughing. "Murti! There are 1,000 men in chains below, or is monsoon coming early?" "Sound is too loud, Murti," shouted M.K. Prabhan, the director. "But you are not to break from action, Kamala Kumari. You are searching, searching for your sailing ship." Wavelets appeared to surge each time two peons, servants, pulled the painted sea tarp on either side. Pirates of the Coromandel was being filmed on limited budget, even for a Gemini studio picture. Though there was little scope for the actress's character development, her brigand hero, the pirate captain whose ship approached, was played by Ravi Chandar. Audiences had chosen Ravi Chandar as the rising male star, and his films always made money. Appearing opposite the beloved action hero could be Kamala's breakout from starlet to star. When Prabhan gave the word, Kamala clasped her ringed fingers above her breast and opened her glistening lips to sing. She had perfect pitch from classic Carnatic training, but no one would hear her contralto. A playback artist with a higher register would dub in the songs in a recording studio. "Stop and print," shouted Prabhan. "Very pleasant, my dear," he said to Kamala. "Pleasant? Shouldn't there be more emotion? Is there not dread and passion combined here? If only I had lines to speak." "An image is worth 1,000 words," Prabhan walked toward Murti. "No time to waste. We've got Gopu waiting with his serpent. God willing, there will be light for the scales to show up. Snake scales are key."
I think those two passages give a sense of the, first of all, of your colorful writing, and also the range of scenes and experiences in the book that are somewhat divergent, but all come together. I think it's just your use of language draws us into the real texture of the place.
Yeah, I mean, I did live 3 years in India, and otherwise wouldn't ever have been able to write this. As I wouldn't have been able to write Grisha, the Scrivener, if I hadn't lived in the former Soviet Union, and the Ballet Lover if I hadn't followed ballet for a long time. So,
well, and I loved that Anna Pavlova is a thread that runs through this book as well.
It seems she seems to dance in my head. She did, yes. She and it really was true that she died in a hotel called the Hotel des Andes. And she patterned herself in some way after these sacred Indian dancers.
Barbara Bear, the last Devadasi, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your wealth of knowledge on that part of the world and on this form of dance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Barbara L. Bear, and her book is The Last Devadasi. Join Barbara at the Occidental Center for the Arts on Sunday, January 13th from 3 to 5, where she'll read from the book, and you can enjoy some Indian food, dance, and maybe a little gin, which was imbibed by many of the characters in The Last Devadasi. So why not? January 13th at the Occidental Center for the Arts, right off Bohemian Highway in Occidental, California. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Off the Page Readers Theater has become a regular part of our local literary and performance scene in Sonoma County, and I thought it would be fun to preview their upcoming winter show, What Goes Around, which will play at Copperfield's Bookstore in Montgomery Village on January 18th and 19th at 7:30, and play in Sebastopol on January 20th at 3 in the afternoon at Abacus at 101 South Main Street. Hillary Moore and the Off the Page Readers Theater, welcome. And looking forward to talking a bit and hearing some of your pieces. Hillary, tell us a little bit about Off the Page.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for having us come on. Off the Page Readers Theater started in 2013, and it came about as a result of a friendship I made with Mike and Pat Hayes when we were doing a 24-hour theater project in Petaluma. We just fell in like, and I had wanted to move north. I was with Petaluma Readers for a while, but I wanted to expand a little bit and not just do Petaluma. So I basically just kind of convinced them to start this little company with me, and we grew little by little, and now we have 6 members, still keeping it small, and we like that.
And you work with local authors.
I think that's our specialty, really. Our trademark is that we perform almost all local writers' work. You know, there's so much talent in this county. The exposure is different than when you present something in a theatrical way. It just kind of brings their words to life in a way that they might not be brought otherwise.
And a reader's theater is not a full-blown theater. It is, I think you've said in the past, acting from the neck up or something like that.
I think I say from the waist up.
Because
we do very minimal use of props or costumes, although on occasion we do add a little something. But basically we're in front of our music stands that have the scripts on them. But by the time we have a show ready, we pretty much know all our lines. So it's really more, I call us actors, not readers.
Well, very good. And your winter show is featuring pieces by 10 authors. And what is the name of your winter show?
The name is What Goes Around.
what goes around, and maybe can we hear a little piece to give our listeners a flavor of what you do?
Sure. I'd like to introduce the first piece with our actor Kathleen Haney and our actor Jeff Savage.
Cash Flow by Lori Ream. I've been thinking about all the money there is. How much is there? Does anyone know? What of countless quarters and couch cushions and pennies flipped into fountains? Consider the obscene sum squandered on Super Bowl commercials. $5 million per half minute. Imagine Toyota, Pepsi, Verizon running just a 15-second spot announcing,
"We're donating $2.5 million toward cancer cures."
To provide showers, soup, and shelter for those without homes. To directly decrease the deficit. To teach teens to read. To plant trees. To advocate peace. To grow hope. Cutting their ad by a mere 15 seconds, the corporation could shell out $2.5 million for public coffers. Or not.
Flag on the play.
Offensive pushing of petty products.
So remind us of the author and the name of that piece.
That piece is called Cash Flow, and it's by Lori Ream.
And how do you thematically work with the pieces or solicit pieces around a theme?
That's a good question. First of all, we have to duke it out to choose the theme, and that is no easy task. Throughout the year, from one show to another, whenever I hear a title or a snippet, a couple of words that seem like they might work, I write them down. And then I solicit from all the actors in the troupe to please send me two or three titles. And then Jeff and I are the designated choosers now, because otherwise it just took us days and we couldn't, with six of us, we could never come to an end to it. And for some reason, even though we think very differently about a lot of things, we are just on the money when it comes to choosing something that we both like. It last couple of times, it's happened really quick. So once we have the theme, we send out a call to all the writers that we know and the writers that they know. And material comes pouring in, and we read. And it starts to narrow itself down somehow. I just, after these many years of doing it, we kind of know what is likely to work. And then we get together and have a big reading where we read our favorite pieces and sometimes fight for the ones we like if they didn't make it universally. And we end up with a show that the pieces just fit together. I can't tell you how that happens. It's some kind of little magic where they make themselves into a concert.
And then how long do you rehearse before each show?
We have six rehearsals, a table reading and then six rehearsals. And that seems to be a good formula for us. Of course, if we needed something more, we might have it. For example, if a piece needed some space work more than we're used to, or handling of a few props, we might have to do an extra rehearsal for that piece.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And the next piece you're going to do is written by David Beckman. And David has had longer full-length plays produced here in Sonoma County and elsewhere, I believe. But he seems to also excel in the short form.
We love his work. We've performed his work before, and we just always love the little twists or surprises that are in it. The dialogue always seems very crisp. And there's always underlining meanings, which we really appreciate as actors and readers and writers.
Well, let's take a listen to this piece by David Beckman.
Okay. The Exit Interview by David Beckman. Well, you won't get me back in there, not with that ending.
The ending was brilliant. The whole film was brilliant.
I'm starving. Let's go eat.
At 10 o'clock? Forget it. It's too late. Besides, you had all that popcorn.
Popcorn isn't filling. All I can think of is the Golden Wok. Their sesame chicken.
That's a no-no, and you know it. Come on home. There's yogurt in the refrigerator.
Excuse me. Did you just see the film?
As a matter of fact, yes.
I'm from Bissell and Bodine, Information Gathering Service. Would you take a few moments to answer some few questions about it?
Well, we're in a hurry.
No, no. Ask away.
Well, if you're sure, great. First, how would you rate it for general appeal? A 10 is tops, extremely appealing, down to a 1 for no appeal whatsoever.
9. It was an excellent film. To see what goes on in that world, to get a glimpse into the hearts and souls of those people. Very intelligent and well presented.
And you, ma'am?
4.
Why?
It was unrealistic.
Okay, a 9 and a 4. Next, how would you rate the direction?
It was excellent. The strongest point, in fact.
Meaning 10?
Oh, 9, certainly.
I give it a 4. No, a 3.
Oh, please. His vision, his mastery of the language of cinema, his fluid approach to scenes, his clarity, superb.
It had too many long shots and slow dissolves. It needed more close-ups on faces.
Honey, this director is famous for his sweep. For the, quote, wide eye, unquote, of his camera.
Those shots are boring.
Right. A 9 and a 3. Thank you. Next, the acting. How would you rate it?
7.
A 3 and an 8.
Pardon?
Everyone gets a 3, but him, he gets an 8.
Giancarlo?
He was gorgeous.
Let's focus on a couple of specific scenes. The eating scene. How would you...
Which one?
Well, there was just one eating scene.
No, there was the scene where the woman wears the blue dress and sits with her legs crossed, dangling her shoe.
Yes, that's the one on the terrace.
And eats raw oysters. I give that scene a 2.
2.
Then there was the other one in the bedroom.
That wasn't an eating scene.
Why not?
Because no one ate anything.
You weren't watching, were you? Someone did eat in that scene, all right. She did. Stan, let's see if you were watching. What did she eat in the bedroom scene?
Chocolate.
Oh, the chocolate. Yes, she did eat chocolate.
I give that scene a 9. This was a woman who knew how to eat chocolate. Took her time, held it in her fingers, licked it slowly, finally sucked out the creamy center. Very believable.
9 for the bedroom scene. And you, sir?
I'm not sure. Aren't we skipping ahead? We were...
On the terrace, yes. You, ma'am, gave that a 2.
She was too passive in that scene, too willing to go along with him. That was bad enough. But on top of that, those oysters... All I could think of was the last time I had raw oysters.
Oh, no, Glenda.
We were at the shore. They were supposed to be fresh. Stanley here had picked them out carefully at the outdoor market. Said they were perfect. I ate 4 of them. They were too salty, which should have tipped me off. And what's the word? Chewy. Way too chewy. Cut to the emergency room. 3 in the morning. I'm upchucking and
Glenda, warts. Please. My goodness.
I'm dying. Losing meals I'd had earlier. Passing out and popping goes a needle for intravenous feeding. Liquid, whatever. I'm not saying I was brought back from the brink. Not saying I saw the big light and heard Mantovani. But I was sick. Wretched. All because of Stanley's oysters. I give the scene a 1.
Well, that's objective. The scene was a 10. It was the pivotal scene of the film and wonderfully done. And it wasn't about oysters. In fact, it wasn't even about the woman. It was his scene. Here we saw his emerging discontent, his frustrations with the pettiness of the household, his deep wish for fulfillment on some other plane, not as a father or husband, but as a man. As you are man, autonomous, yet required to act, to move in the world, yet not be of it. Man as thinker, yes, but also as agent of change. It goes back to Camus, to Sartre. I was moved by it. A man balancing his ontological concerns with his existential responsibilities. Riveting. It's a 10.
Yakka, yakka, yakka.
I beg your pardon.
Always with the big words.
Only a few more questions to go. The love scene, how do you rate it?
Nine.
My.
I give it a one because, first, I think it was unnecessary to the film. And second, I object, on philosophical grounds, to sexual acts in films.
Oy.
I won't bore you with why.
Thank you, Lord.
Except to say, the eye is drawn to people in the act of sex. Not as the characters in a drama, but as the actors pretending. Or not pretending, as the case may be. And we are caught in that never-never land between reality and fantasy. And we ask, are they faking? And the mere act of asking destroys the illusion. Plus, the mind and senses are affected in a way that traduces the scene's meaning in the film. Viewing sex turns one willy-nilly into a voyeur and unwittingly takes one out of the film, out of the story, and deep into...
Into what?
Nothing.
No, I'm intrigued. You've obviously thought a great deal about this.
As a viewer, one is drawn into the recesses of one's own...
One's own?
Obsessions.
But that's good. Shouldn't art do that?
No, definitely not.
I'm increasing my vote to a 10.
And why?
Jean, what was his name?
Giancarlo.
Gorgeous. Killer body, beautiful shoulders and arms.
Thank you, Roger Ebert.
His muscles so beautifully formed, and those cute veins down the, the biceps. The muscle there, you can just feel the blood pumping. And the
very intellectual, Glenda. Are you getting all this?
Everything isn't intellectual, Stanley. This is a movie. Entertainment, not one of your courses. Where was I?
Blood pumping.
His body, his chest, but more than that, the way he moved. He was like dancing. She was dancing to his rhythm. In lovemaking, it was a dance. It was sensual and beautiful. When he removed her blouse so slowly, and she in turn unbuttoned his shirt, no, popped the buttons off, one after the other, pop, pop. Did he care they'd have to be sewn back on later? No. Then he removed her bra, not by making her turn around and unsnapping it clumsily with cold fingers, but by removing it a strap at a time with his teeth. First one strap, then the other. Her neck arched back, his hand cradling the back of her head, supporting her. Then him kissing her eyelids, her neck, her breasts. That's art. No big wide sweep, just one heck of a good close-up.
Well, you certainly vividly play back.
Wait, I'm not through. The scene was about more than sex. It showed that he loved her pure and simple. He cared for her. He adored her for all her faults. Sure, she had trouble keeping the house straight. She slept late, she ate too much, but he loved her anyway. Few men, if any, have that capacity.
What capacity?
Don't encourage her.
To love a woman for who she is, for her natural qualities. It's tragic, that's what it is. So many lonely women, trying to be something different than they are. Lose weight, look younger, be smarter. All for what? For love, which won't come anyway, because if it were there, it would be there, period. End of problem.
Can we get back to the film?
Sure, Stan. Get back to the film.
Oh, we're almost finished. The scene in the church.
Perfectly realized. Deeply moving. I commend the cinematographer for that scene. The lighting was extraordinary. After the dim lighting of the bedroom scene, indicating shame, things hidden from view, etc., here we are in the quiet sanctuary of the church. And the fact that it was a country church in plain surroundings showed the ordinariness of our earthly quest, while light was, of course, a metaphor for grace.
It was too damn bright. Wasn't it supposed to be dusk? Where do you see light like that at dusk, streaming in like there's a floodlight hanging up there? Nowhere I've been. But then I haven't been to Spain, so excuse me.
Finally, the last scene.
The graveyard scene.
Phony.
Deeply moving. Her death symbolized...
It's ridiculous that she died.
Symbolized in him the death of his more earthly, sensual side. That part of him with her.
Such a male way to wrap it up. Get her conveniently out of the way.
He would be alone with his sorrow in a hostile universe.
All that so he could conveniently chase the chippy at the cappuccino shop?
What? He had no interest in her. She had nothing to do with it.
Ha! He made eyes at her all through the cappuccino scene.
Getting back to the grave scene.
1 10 0 11 The scene had all the tragic undercurrents of the best of Buñuel, Bertolucci, Kubrick. It had nothing to do with another woman, for Christ's sake. It was about his fate, his destiny. He'd come full circle, and the symbolism is complete.
Is that what you'd do if something happened to me, Stanley? Just lower me down, spout off a few things about what I symbolize, and head for the chippy at some goddamn coffee shop?
Well, that wraps things up. Thank you for your time. I'll just be moving on.
Stanley, I'm hungry. I'm going to the Golden Walk.
It's so late.
I'm going for sesame chicken. Are you coming or not?
I don't think so.
Oh, that's really too bad.
I'll be at home. I have to get up early.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Ticket for one, please.
Thank you. And what was the name of that piece?
The name of that was Exit Interview by David Beckman.
And an example of not only off-the-page reader's theater, but the wit and intelligence that David Beckman brings to his pieces, too. I want to thank you for coming in and sharing these works with us today. You have made off-the-page reader's theater kind of a staple now in Sonoma County with your regular performances around the county. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've been here with Hilary Moore and Off the Page Readers Theater. Their upcoming shows are Friday and Saturday, January 18th and 19th at 7:30 in the evening at Copperfield, Santa Rosa in Montgomery Village, and at Abacus in Sebastopol on Sunday the 20th at 3 in the afternoon. Barbara Bear will be launching her book, The Last Devadasi, at the Occidental Center for the Arts on Sunday the 13th with a reading and celebration from 3 to 5. I encourage you to patronize our local authors and performers, and I thank you for listening today. Visit norcalpublicmedia.org, where you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows. I've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.